Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live in the back of Roberta's Pizzeria on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45. Joined as usual in the studio with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez, Jack and Joe in the engineering room, and today we have a special guest, Piper from Booker and Dax Research Lab downtown. Hey Pipes, how you doing?
Good?
Yeah, it's called a microphone. You got to talk into it. So I have another person I can brutalize on air, right? It's good business, no? It's good. Anyway, call in all your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. All right, so let's get to some of the email questions that we have already. Again with the not getting the right thing on my iPad. Okay. This is from Paul K. Hi, all. Thanks for your work on the great show, and thanks for answering all of my past questions. My latest question is about baking. In general, I'm happy with the results of my once-per-month attempt at baking bread. However, I'm always a little disappointed by the small, or perhaps non-existent, oven spring that I get. I haven't had any real-life training. My only knowledge is from books. But my impression from those books is that oven spring is to be expected and should be noticeable. Although my bread does rise nicely before putting it in the oven, i.e., I guess when he's proofing, as I say, I'm always a little disappointed with the amount it springs during those first few minutes of baking. Perhaps I simply shouldn't expect to see anything dramatic. Any help would be most appreciated. All the best, Paul. Okay. All right. Here's the problem. First of all, I am by no means a bread expert. There are people who all they do all day, all night is think about bread. And so, you know, you always hesitate when there's people like that out there to make any kind of statement at all. But that said, I feel confident that I don't know enough information right now to answer your question. So what we need for a real troubleshooting of your bread recipe, first of all, what style of bread are you making? Like, what are you looking to get? Like, do you want a dense crumb structure, a very open crumb structure? What kind of crust? Crumb structure is a gross word, huh?
Yeah.
Nastasha just made her crumb structure face, which is very similar to vegan face. Like, slight difference, only I can tell. There's that, right? And then, in general, I need to know kind of what hydration level you're using. So, like, what style of flour, first of all, how much water you're adding to the flour, and then how you're raising it and forming it and proofing it and whatnot. In general, oven spring is generated. First of all, most of the stuff that I read on the inner line, what do you call it? Internet. On the internet about oven spring, a lot of it is kind of BS. Specifically, I don't think that some people say that it's because you're increasing the rate of yeast reaction at the last minute as the bread is baking, and that's what's doing it. I think that's almost probably certainly not the case, because the oven spring happens very, very quickly and probably not in enough time for yeast to start reacting and all of a sudden producing CO2 in overdrive. I think what's going on is you need a high initial heat, high initial burst of heat in the oven to rapidly expand the gases in the cell of the dough structure and then set the dough structure before the dough structure breaks. What you're looking at to get a good oven spring is, one, there has to be a good gluten network in there that's going to allow it to hold the gas as it expands. It's going to have to be kind of formed properly, and it's going to have enough air bubbles in it already that can expand, right? So it's formation of the you know, right number of, and you know, amount, size of air bubbles, getting them kind of big enough but keeping the structure of the dough intact so that it can raise up and spring, getting a very high heat both from the bottom and from the top. So with a baking stone at the bottom with a very initial high preheat, and then with steam injection or some form of steam to get a rapid heat transfer into the loaf on the and forget, I'm not even talking about the actual development of what the crust is like, which is another thing that steam can do, but I'm just saying rapid heat into the dough. A third thing is a proper slashing pattern in the dough will allow heat to get in and allow it to expand more, like physically allow it to expand more. So there's the slashing patterns that you make on it. There's a proper formation of the dough, proper proofing of it, and making sure that the dough has the proper structure to get it to work properly. But very difficult to figure out exactly which one of those problems you have. Most likely, your oven's not tricked out enough for it. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what kind of oven that you're using. There's an interesting book that I haven't read before, but that gets very high recommendations, and I want to read it, called Bread Science, The Chemistry and Craft of Bread Making, which came out fairly recently. And there's a bunch of chunks on the on the internet that you can read of that on their website. And then I would look at a Fresh Loaf and those other kind of like large kind of conglomeration of bloggers who get together and talk about this stuff. I mean, if you're just baking occasionally, sometimes it can be difficult to wade through all the information that they provide. And of course, a lot of it's red herrings because everyone, like all of us, is just experimenting all the time. But anyway, I hope that helps. Does that seem like it made any sense at all?
Yes.
No? Yeah. All right. Hello and good morning, Team Cooking Issues. I like that, Team Cooking Issues. Not Cooking Issues Team Cooking Issues.
Yeah.
You appreciate that?
That's
okay. Nice. Can you describe the pros and cons of open and closed baths for low-temperature cooking? A friend is tempted to purchase a sous vide Supreme rather than Polyscience Immersion Circulator for home use because the salesperson suggested that an open bath will cause the temperature to fluctuate and cause a loss of control. The guy was a schmuck. Thank you, Matthew in Chicago. Well, I don't know the man that you're discussing personally. I didn't see him, but based on the one statement we have of his, which is that an open bath circulator is going to have large temperature fluctuations, yes, he is a schmuck. So if the rest of his thinking is in line with the thinking he gave you right there, then yes, a schmuck call is in order. The main difference between a sous vide Supreme and a real immersion circulator isn't necessarily whether it's covered or not, because it's very easy to cover a bath when you use an immersion circulator. The main difference is in the circulation itself. Now, to go back for a second, in case someone strapped you down to a chair and this your torture is to listen to this radio show and you haven't listened to it before, what we're talking about are pieces of equipment that allow you to do low-temperature cooking, cooking at very precise temperatures that are very close to the actual temperature you want to cook to. All right, so that's low-temperature cooking. And the main piece of equipment that most of us use to do that is the immersion circulator. And what that does is it keeps water at a very, very, or anything really, at a very accurate temperature and allows you to do all these new effects that you have for low temperature cooking. Now, you notice the word immersion circulator. So there's circulation of water, and the circulation is what allows you to get very even temperatures over the entire bath, to within like a couple tenths of a degree. Now, if you don't cover that circulating bath, what's going to happen is you will get evaporation off of the surface of the bath, right? And so you'll be losing a lot of heat. And if you didn't have adequate circulation, you will get a temperature stratification in the bath, right? I mean, no duh. Obviously, you'll get temperature stratification, but adequate circulation is going to prevent any real stratification of temperature once you get any reasonable depth below the bottom of the below the surface of the water. Now, if you have an unstirred bath, right, the situation is horrible. What happens if you do not cover an unstirred bath? You will get constant evaporation off of the surface, and you will get, in essence, over time, a temperature gradient established as water evaporates off of the top of the bath, and by evaporating cools it because it's evaporative cooling, and so you'll get a temperature gradient set up that probably is fairly static over a long cook once it settles out, I would guess. Assuming that humidity of your room remains constant. Now, aside from the fact what I just said, that you must at all times cover a non-circulating bath, and that you don't need to necessarily cover a circulating bath to get an accurate temperature, it is always good practice to cover a circulating bath. Always good practice, because you lose so much energy through the top of the bath. you know, as things evaporate, that sometimes in larger bath situations, your circulator might not have enough power to get it up to the temperature that you want, because they only typically have between 750 and 1,000 watts of heating power. Two, you are going to take a lot longer to come up to temperature than you otherwise would. And three, you're going to be evaporating off stuff like a mother. And so even over relatively short cooking times, you're going to lose water. Over long cooking times, like overnight, you could potentially boil, or not boil, but evaporate all the water out of your bath, and your product can be ruined. And fourth, in a circulated bath, if you've done a bad job and not put a rack or some sort of weight on top of your food such that it's like definitively sunk under the surface of the liquid, you know, if you cover it, even if a little bit pokes up, you'll still get a fairly close temperature, as long as the thing's totally sealed and covered up to what you want, just not as effective a heat transfer mechanism. So always a good idea to cover a bath, the only exception being if you have a reheat bath at a relatively low temperature during service and you're going in and out of it all the time. But under other circumstances, I always, always, always recommend covering the bath. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. How you doing, Nastasha?
I'm good.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Anything good happening?
Nope.
We got some good news on the Booker and Dax front. Tristan Willey, you know, the opening, or you know, the guy who opened it with us, you know, the manager of Booker and Dax, won best bartender in the country, according to Eater. Eater Nasty. Wow. And the guys are quick on the quick on the clap-a-thon there, right? So that was good news, right?
Yeah, that's great news.
It's good business. Love myself some Tristan Willey. A little too tall for my taste, but other than that, good man, right? Yeah, yeah. Okay, we have a question in from Matt Mincer on brines. Hello, Cooking Issues folks. I've got a question or three about brines. When I barbecue pork or chicken, I make a brine with a heavy dose of my dry rub in it. The theory being that the water is being drawn into the meat and will carry some of that flavor from the spice with it. But I was listening to one of your podcasts where Harold McGee said that the flavor molecules from spices are probably too large to penetrate the cells of the meat. The question I have is, am I wasting my time and my spices by adding them to the brine? Has anybody studied which flavor molecules will penetrate the meat, if any? And finally, how much brining is too much? It seems at some point the osmosis would reach equilibrium and anything more would give diminishing returns. I'm sure it depends on the cut of meat, but is there any rule of thumb? Thanks, Matt. And a P.S. I wrote in a few weeks ago about using mason jars in my centrifuge, and for the record, they work about 75% of the time. The other 25%, not so much. I'm assuming what that means is like awful things happened, right? And when you assume, Piper, that what he means is awful things have happened?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my guess.
Piper, put your headphones on so you can actually hear.
So, this is Piper's first time on the radio. He, you know, he's not so much with the radio thing. He's from Vermont. They don't have radios there yet. Right? Is that true, Piper?
Very true.
Yeah. So here's the deal. I think you're pretty much right, and Harold's pretty much right, and that most brines don't really penetrate the meat to a very large distance. And so you're probably wasting a good bit of your spices. However, like brining something – hold on a second. We're getting some sort of feedback action. Are you getting hearing that, Jack? Some sort of feedback action?
It's Piper's phone.
It's Piper's phone? Nice. Vermont. So the thing is that I think you could probably get pretty much the same reaction by doing your brine and then rubbing your spices on after it comes out of the brine. I mean, that's what I would do. Salt obviously gets carried into the meat because it's an extremely small molecule. I don't really know what the penetration effects of something like sugar is. Nitrates penetrate in, obviously, otherwise curing wouldn't work. But larger molecules tend, I think, not to make it into the meat. I think that's accurate fact. Acids tend to do certain work, but they tend not to penetrate far, which is why you get kind of a different texture on the surface of a meat or any place where there's a cleft in the meat where things can get into it. You can get effect from acids and intermuscular connections and stuff, but you're not going to get an effect from something like that in the dead center of a piece of meat in any reasonable amount of time. I think you're right. I think that, you know, there is a diminishing return time, but that diminishing return time is going to depend almost primarily on the thickness of the piece of meat you use and the brine strength that you use. So there's no real no real rule of thumb on brining the same way there would be on, let's say, kind of curing, where everything's been written down by you know, the USDA and the various curing authorities on it. I mean, Piper, you know any rule of thumb? Any no, you disagree with anything I said?
No.
No? Yeah, nice, nice. I need some, you know, Piper, you need to, like, you do disagree with me. Are you going to be like Nastasha where you don't disagree with me on air and then later you're going to tell me I'm a douche?
No, he'll tell me.
He'll tell you that I'm a douche?
Yes.
And then you'll tell me and I'll yell at you? Is,
yes,
that,
exactly.
Is that how this is going to work?
Yeah, that's how it
works. Chain of command.
Oh, jeez. Oh, jeez. All right, listen. Hey, Jack, let's go to our first commercial break and come back with more cooking issues.
You're listening to Kill Me in the Summertime by Dead Stars on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Nothing left to hide. I know why. Life is what they say. Sun erases again. Everything I'm hoping for, but I don't need you in the summertime.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Did you guys steal that music from, like, the Hayden Planetarium's, like, universe movie that they play right when you show up?
It sounds like it. Maybe, like, Wizard of Oz on loop or something, too. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think that's what it is, though. It's like, you know, you go and they're like, there are billions of stars. And it's like, wheedly deedly deedly. Can you play me a little bit of that wheedly deedly music? I want some of that. Some of that, like, universe. You know what I'm saying? Like, the spinning
right.
stars and stuff?
Maybe we can, like, fade that in with Fish is Vodka.
Don't mess with the Fish is Fish song.
All right,
don't
okay.
Don't be messing with the Fish is Fish song. Oh, by the way, we haven't talked about that, right? You want to talk about the song that got sent in, the Fish is Vodka?
Yes, it's a, because we couldn't play Vicious Vodka, we have a sound-alike song, and so does the title. And it was composed by someone on Twitter. Jack, do you remember the name of the person? Jack doesn't remember.
You guys are bad people.
Yeah, we did no credit. But next time,
You guys are horrible
you
people.
You texted him, didn't you?
Yes. We'll do another commercial break. Come back with a full thank you. Anyway, so we got one in from @Clefs. Cooking issues. Any ideas on time and temperature for cooking cod sperm sacks low temp? You gotta love a question like that. Cod sperm sacks at low temp. Any way to prevent coagulation of dairy? Also, second question, any way to prevent coagulation of dairy in a high acid system? So here's the thing. Cod sperm, I would never say cod sperm when you're actually going to serve it to someone. I mean, the term that we would use in food circles would be milt, like Uncle Milty. Milt, cod milt. I have not myself cooked cod milt. I've seen it many times. I think I've had it. You've had the cod milt, right, mm-hmm. Stas? Did you enjoy the cod milt?
Yeah.
Yeah? You had it where, Japanese style?
That, yeah, and then with you at, what's that place in San Francisco?
Where?
Your friend.
Which friend?
He does a lot of,
Chris Costantino?
Yeah.
We had milk there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, all right. So I guess, yeah. Anyway, it's got like a texture similar to, like a brains or something like that. But I have no idea how to cook it low temp. I mean, it's got such a delicate structure that I would worry about vacuuming it. I would guess that it coagulates somewhere in the range of where an egg white would coagulate. So you'd probably want to cook it at, like, I don't know, 62, something like that, Celsius. But I don't know, because you're supposed to steam it or fry it or something like that. It's supposed to be a delicate kind of puffy texture. What do you think, Pipes? You think that's a good – what would you do? Have you ever cooked the cod milk?
No. I actually wasn't listening.
Oh, nice. No, it's like, yes! It's like what the hell? Well, Piper, it's because Piper's not trying to buy shoes on Zappos. Like, no, somebody else we know who shall remain – he's not on Facebook.
He just clicked up.
He's not on Facebook, Nista. He's looking up oil polymerization for me. Anyway, so no, I do not have a good time or temperature on it, but I would assume it would be somewhere in that range, like 62. I've never really done even low temp on my favorite kind of, fish gonad part, which is roe. I've never done any really low temperature cooking on that, although I should, because I love shad roe. Shad roe is one of my favorite things to cook. You don't like the shad roe,
no.
Dude. Why do you not like the shad roe?
Something about it. Isn't it like really grainy?
Well, if you overcook it, it's grainy. Yeah.
I had it when it was really grainy.
Who cooked it for you? You gonna call
a restaurant?
Out?
No, I'm not gonna call.
No. All right. Anyway, but the second one, it just so happens at Clef's that we have here Piper, who his family is involved with CP Kelco. Right, we have the man to tell you how to prevent the coagulation of high acid dairy systems. Piper with some pectin. Give me some pectin stabilization knowledge. Drop it on me.
Let's see.
Better protein, be fast, Piper.
Protein protection through
what?
Pectin.
Oh right. My God, Piper.
I'm killing still me. Not listening.
All right, look. The question was, Piper.
Finally.
Snap back.
Okay.
Finally.
The question was how to do high acid dairy systems without coagulation. And the answer I gave it to you, just describe which pectins, is you like pectin to preserve high acid dairy systems.
Pectin and CMC.
That's carboxymethylcellulose, for all of you who don't know what the hell CMC is and think it's a brand of truck. So he's using right? Is that true? Right? Carboxymethylcellulose?
Yep.
Who makes that stuff?
Actually, CP Kelco makes it.
Yeah? All right. Can you buy that from Modernist Pantry?
I think you can.
Piper puts CMC in every freaking thing. Like, first of all, his body doesn't do so well with the gluten, so he, you know.
He uses it for film forming and gluten-free bread.
Yeah.
And also viscosity without having to deal with yield point, like xanthan.
Yeah, yield point, for those of you that have no idea what the hell we're talking about. Yield point, so if you take xanthan gum, it acts a little bit like a fluid gel. You sit it on a surface, you tilt it, and it acts like a gel until you put a certain amount of shear on it, at which point it automatically thins and turns to a liquid. That's called a yield point. So something with a yield point acts like that, as opposed to something that is merely thick but will flow under all circumstances. So two easy real-world examples that don't involve hydrocolloids that you can think of are like maple syrup. No matter how cold it is, it just flows, but slowly. It doesn't have a yield point. Whereas ketchup, right? Ketchup does not flow until shear is applied to it and has a yield point, and it breaks. So that's what a yield point. So Piper's looking to strengthen something in a system without having a yield point. He's using CMC and pectin, but you use a specific pectin, don't you?
There are a couple different types of pectin you can use. I like, let's see. Beta pectin, which is from beets.
Right. And what's the beta refer to for those who are out there in the pectin land?
I don't even know that.
You know what? Like, Piper worked at CP Kelco's like what were you? The research? What were you? In the research labs?
Yeah.
Like busting stuff out?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so Piper will put pectin in just about any damn thing and CMC in just about any damn thing. So give him a recipe. Since you're not gonna tell him, just give him a freaking recipe.
It's complicated.
All right.
High concentration solution of beta pectin, like maybe 5%, is mixed with, the solution you want to acidify, and then it's continually mixed for like an hour or so, and then you slowly add your acid. It depends. I mean, there's so many specifics.
So you're saying it's incredibly difficult.
It's incredibly without an accurate pH meter. I mean, you're gonna just try and pour juice in, like lemon juice into it?
Yeah.
What's he trying to make?
Well, I'm assuming he wants to do like, Calpico water or something like that, or like some sort of like acidified dairy beverage. I'm assuming that's what he's trying to do.
I would say make one high concentration solution of beta pectin or an HM pectin, and then add it in increments of like 1% total weight with the dairy, and then slowly acidify, and you'll see that the flocculation point is going to decrease pH wise.
From pH wise. All right. So, Cles, there you have it. That's not so much a recipe you can take to the bank, but Piper will work on it. He'll get it out to you. By the way, I was looking up, while Piper was talking, I was looking up Aaron's last name, who made the song. His last name is Robertson. So, Aaron Robertson, thank you for the Fish is Fish is Vodka song. We love it a lot. Whoa.
Wow.
Abrupt end on the clap, guys. Jesus. Killing me. Okay. Now, another interesting thing that was brought up a couple weeks ago I didn't answer was an oil polymerization technique that's made in Japan, another thing from Japan, called Katameru Tempuru, which I guess tempuru means like kind of like tempura, right? Tempura? Tempuru? I don't know how to speak Japanese. Anyway, Katameru Tempuru is a powder that you, and I saw the video of it on the internet, amazing. What they want to do is you ever have like a liquid fat and you want to dispose of it and throw it in your trash, you can't because it's a liquid. So what you do is you add this powder to it and it instantly polymerizes, turns to a solid, which you then scrape out of the pan and you can throw in your regular waste trash. Now, that's crazy. I don't know how the hell it works. It says it's some sort of algal thing, some sort of algal seaweed like nonsense. But I was like, nowhere was I able to find what's actually in it, what is actually doing it. And it's clearly some sort of, I mean, it's probably clearly, if not clearly, I guess, some sort of polymerization where the oil is being linked. I doubt they're like instantly hydrogenating it, because I don't know of any way to do that, because it's not a system where they're adding heat. They're literally just adding a powder to the oil and it's turning to a solid, which is nutty. I don't know how the hell it works. Someone out there, please, if you know what this reaction is and what's causing it, because remember, there's ways to do it in like that I found that are very, very non-food grade. But the question is, how do you do it in a food grade way such that you're not doing something crazy to your pan? Like, are they somehow some sort of instant saponification reaction where they're turning into a soap? I have no idea. Someone please tell me. The only way I know how to solidify a fat like that, hardcore solidify it, is to add large amounts, like upwards of 10% by weight of mono and diglycerides. When that, like, so you could take a liquid fat, add 10% mono and diglycerides to it, and you know, heat it a little bit, and then when it cools, it will thicken and turn to a solid, and you can scrape it out. And that's the only way that I've done it, in the kitchen before. But I don't know. Anyway, so we're looking that up, and we'll take a second break, and we'll come right back with Cooking Issues.
You're listening to Leaving by Dead Stars on heritageradionetwork.org. Have we lost all control? Well, I don't know what I should do. Wake me up when you know, and I hope that we get there soon.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
We're back. Okay, back on the bread. I was thinking about this for a second. I read a couple of interesting articles. They don't actually relate to the question about oven spring, but I thought they were kind of interesting. One is that these nut jobs are trying to figure out a way to determine how their bread is going to react to baking, and instead of doing the obvious thing for us, which would be to bake it, they put it in a vacuum chamber. And these guys, by putting in a vacuum chamber, they expand all the air cells that are the air bubbles that are already in the dough. And they claim that at any point in the bread making process, after the initial kind of mixing and the air incorporation has happened, that they can get good correlations to the final bake volume just by putting the sucker in a vacuum and seeing how high it can raise up. There's another interesting picture on vacuum mixing in the bread science book that I told you about that's available in the chunk that's online, where she reproduces a picture of a bread that was mixed under a vacuum. It had the craziest pore structure. It was considered a bad pore structure, but I thought very interesting in that. Like, now I'm spending all morning thinking about various ways to put vacuums on bread. But the other really interesting thing is an article I read about the temperatures at which the bread, and this relates back to oven spring, is setting. And so the point is that the protein structure in a good bread, in a good well-made dough, the protein structure is going to hold the gas bubble integrity up to a point of about 60 degrees Celsius, where a crappy bread dough is going to hold its structure up to a point of about 50 degrees Celsius. And so the key difference there is that that's right around the temperature that the starch gelatinization is taking place. So the protein is really only there to hold the structure of the bread while you're waiting for the starch to gelatinize and set. And that's why, and I think we've discussed about it a couple of times in the past, when you're working on a gluten-free bread, like a lot of the problem is just getting it to react properly to the initial bakeout. So it's the initial bakeout of it that's hard, because you're getting the proteins, they have to hold there until the interior of the bread gets up to 50 or 60. And that's why when we're doing experiments, we'll experiment with, things that have weird kind of pre-gelling characteristics, like you'll add something to hold structure like a xanthan or like a CMC, and then you'll add something to actually gel in that mid-range temperature where those other things are going to start to fail, like a methylcellulose or some other sort of heat gelling property. Because the idea is that it's not that the protein is important. I don't think it's important, but it's not, majorly important to the final texture of the bread. I think the major impact from the final temperature on the bread is going to be the starches and how they gelatinize. However, the major impact to the formation of that final structure is going to be how the protein works. And so that's the really dig that you get when you're trying to formulate a bread without protein, without gluten proteins. Wouldn't you say that's...
Yeah.
Yeah. Now Piper's learned to do the Nastasha and just say yes. Okay. Joshua wrote in last week. We didn't get to it on beer. I hope this is still the correct email, and it is, even though we didn't answer it last week. Obviously, Nastasha got the email. A few questions. I'm an all-grain brewer, because I didn't answer this last week, did I, Stas? I'm an all-grain brewer, and I have access to grains, hops, good brewing equipment, wort, etc., which, like, for some reason, I don't know. Wort, I call it wort, but I was told that brewers call it wort.
Okay.
No, you don't care. You don't give a crap. Okay. Are there some interesting things I can do with these base ingredients beyond beer, or the equipment used for it beyond low temperature cooking? That's interesting. I've been trying to use mashing techniques and use the amylase when you're doing an all grain mash, you're using barley, malted barley. When you're malting the barley, you're just allowing a little bit of the grain to grow. You're allowing it to germinate a little bit, and then you're stopping that. While the enzymes are in there that will convert the starch in the barley, eventually convert the starch into sugars so that the growing embryo can use them, you kill that such that the enzymes haven't been destroyed, but that the embryo isn't using all of that stuff and isn't wasting any of the starch, because you want to convert all that starch using the enzymes to sugar. So I've been, not with much success, but trying to experiment using the enzymes in that to add other starches to do cooking-related things. So to break down potatoes, for instance, or break down even further sweet potatoes using a mixture of amylases from grains. But I haven't had any sort of luck that makes me want to think that that's what I want to do for the next, 10 years. I'm having much more luck with... not with grain-based ferments doing interesting thing, but Harold McGee has been turning me on to some really interesting rice-based fermentations, not Japanese, not koji-based, but, you know, other weird symbiotic like mixtures of bacteria and fungal and yeast elements. And I forget what the name of it is, but he said these weird little, they're called yeast balls that are from China that McGee kind of turned me on to that make this amazing fermented rice gruel that tastes unlike anything ever. So I've had more luck using that in culinary applications, but I haven't really had done much with beer. Now, malt is delicious, and malt, I think, especially even the dried stuff that you can buy or the extract, is an underused ingredient from a culinary standpoint. It's delicious. You know, malted mashed potatoes, you know, not malt like, you know, baker's malt or like malt like you make milkshakes with, but like large amounts of, you know, brewer's malt, malt powder, you know, DME, dry malt extract, which you don't use because you're all grain, is a awesome addition, flavoring addition to many things that I use. Two, I have a fair bit of beer. What are some interesting things I can do to play with beer for sweet or savory applications? I've been thinking about foams with methocel F50 and have used it in cheese preparations with sodium citrate. Look, methocel F50 beer applications are kind of one of the classic applications of methocel F50. I mean, I think one of the first, in fact, the first application I saw, methocel F50 is a hydrocolloid derived from cellulose that has very good whipping properties. And it's used mainly by chefs to make very dense, like kind of shaving creamy consistency foams, because it makes a very fine celled foam as opposed to something almost akin to an egg white, as opposed to kind of the light, airy foams that are produced by things like by things like lecithin. You know, VersaWhip is another foaming agent, but I tend to think that Methocel F50 makes kind of a finer, kind of more egg whitey foam than VersaWhip usually does, although VersaWhip is also good for certain applications. Anyway, Methocel F50 also does something VersaWhip can't do, which is if you make a like a whipped egg white texture thing with Methocel F50, a foam, you can pipe it onto a tray, throw it in a dehydrator at 135 Fahrenheit for a couple of hours, then turn it down to hold it, and it'll make a crunchy, like a crunchy meringue, crispy thing with no protein in it. That's amazing. Now, the first application I saw of it, what methocel F50 was, in fact, beer. It was Sam Mason, who I don't know when his ice cream company is starting up again. Do you know? Does anyone know? Anyone?
No.
Anyone? It's going to be delicious, I'm sure. Anyway, he was doing back at WD50 when he was a pastry chef at WD50, was making Guinness foam with methocel F50, and as I remember, I tasted it and my feelings was it was delicious. Obviously, cooking with beer is good. I've been using it a lot in cocktail preparations. Of course, that's nothing new. So I guess I don't have anything really new. I like this cheese application with sodium citrate. So I'm assuming you're making like processed cheese with beer. You think that would mean, or you'd have to add some sort of like a casein, extra casein to it. I did some work with a product called rennet casein, and rennet casein is casein that's been produced from the process, like where you actually rennet it, and then you break it down, powder it, and you can reuse that to make cheese analogs. And so I've done some initial experiments with rennet casein, but I'm sure that as long as you get the pH right with the beer, that you can make a pretty interesting kind of beer cheese. In other words, I would be most interested in something not that had the flavor of cheese, but had the meltability of cheese, but tasted like beer. And I think that would be eminently possible with beer, rennet casein, and the right emulsifying salt. So I wouldn't just use citrate. You'd use a
Dave, you have a call. And let's keep it to one question. It's not a personal phone call.
You're telling me it's not a personal phone call? The lady who's buying shoes on the internet? All right, caller, you're on the air.
I'm not buying shoes. And caller, you have one
caller,
question.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave and Nastasha and friends. This is Brian in San Francisco. Excuse me, I have a cold. Two questions. First is lecithin. I found in my natural food store the soy lecithin, which looks kind of like bee pollen. It's the what kind of crumbles.
Right.
And then, but I've seen some recipes that want liquid. So what's the difference?
Oh.
And I guess the first they call soy lecithin.
Yeah, almost all the lecithin that you buy in is from soy, and it's not that that's the only lecithin that's out there. It's just a byproduct of manufacturing all the other soy products. They have soy lecithin. I've never used liquid lecithin. You ever use liquid Piper?
Yeah.
Did you like it? I mean, it's like,
yeah, I hate the granules.
Well, the granules are the granules are obviously the worst. The powder is pretty good. You can buy a powdered one, and the problem with the granules. is, first of all, I think they tend to accentuate the off flavor that you can get from lecithin if you use it too much, and also they're hard to get. What? What do you say? You still there? They're hard to get into the they're hard to get into solution sometimes, the granules, and the whereas the powder is, like, you know, easier. But the liquid, I mean, assuming if you can buy the liquid, if you can tolerate having extra, you know, liquid, I'm sure it's not, I'm sure it's oil based, right?
Yeah, sure.
But if you could have it, you know, because lecithin would rather be in oil than in water. Whenever you're talking about an emulsifier, you have to look at what's called the hydrophobic the hydrophilic lipophilic balance, where you're looking at, is it an oil loving emulsifier? Is it a water loving emulsifier? And the big mistake most people make with lecithin is, although it's kind of somewhere near the middle, it's not extreme on either side, lecithin is an oil-loving emulsifier. So if it's coming as a liquid, it's almost certainly coming in an oil-based liquid. Now, I've never used liquid lecithin, but I would guess it's a lot easier to use, because the pain in the butt about lecithin is making sure it's in the liquid properly. Right? Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. I think we lost a caller because we have some sort of, like, weird feedback loop going on here. But back to cheese for 1 second. The book that you guys want to get, and I think I've mentioned it on the show here before, is Processed Cheese and Analogs by Adnan Tamimi. And that's going to have all the recipes you need. And you can look at a good bunch of it on Google Books and see what's going on. Finally, on the way out, we have a question. Well, okay, one more thing on cheese. Can sodium hexametaphosphate be used as a replacement for sodium citrates in recipes, as well as for sequestering calcium? If yes, is there a standard scaling amount for the amount used? I'm thinking specifically about a modernist mac and cheese recipe. Sodium hexametaphosphate is not a single thing. It's a group of polyphosphate salts, and it's a monster at sequestering calcium. It's not a straight replacement for sodium citrate, because they have kind of different functions in a mac and cheese. They function differently. Usually, when you're making a cheese based thing, you need to add not just one emulsifying salt, but two or three. The function you need depends a lot on the pH of your system. So certain of the salts are more basic than others, and so you need to add them to get your pH in the right level. And also, they tend to have different textures depending on which one you use. And unfortunately, it's not a straightforward thing. It's kind of a little bit of a dark art. And so it requires a lot of experimentation. A lot of it is still just people, like, testing recipes and keeping logbooks of what they do. But sodium hexametaphosphate and sodium citrate together, you should be able to get a lot of things under your belt having those two ingredients on hand when you're doing cheeses. Finally, can I explain my home seltzer system? Yes. Here's what you do to make the – if you have the money and the time but you don't want to spend money or time later, what you do is you get an under-the-counter ice machine, and then you drill a hole in the side of the under-counter ice machine. This is what I kind of have at home. What I have at home is a slightly more ghetto version of this. But you take an ice machine, you drill holes in it, right? You buy a cold plate. Go to Mark Powers. They're in Guntersville, Alabama, cheapest. Get a cold plate. Two circuits. One circuit of a cold plate is not enough to get your seltzer cold enough for what you want to do here, right? So what a cold plate is it's a big stainless steel coil that's embedded in an aluminum block, and you keep that underneath ice, right? Now, one chain of a cold chain is not going to drop the temperature enough. So what you do is you put the in... I forgot. You have to buy a carbonator. A carbonator is a giant tank that holds water at room temperature with a pump, the same kind of pump. It's a rotary vane pump made by Procon usually, and it's the same pump they use in an espresso machine, and that's hooked up to your water supply. So you put your water supply straight out of your sink in through a filter. You put that goes through a filter. Once it goes through the filter, it gets hooked onto the pump on your carbonator, right? You then get a 20-pound CO2 tank. You want to run it about 95, 96, 98 PSI, somewhere in there, into the tank. Now, your water mains don't have enough pressure to inject water into a system that has that high of a pressure. So the Procon pump overcomes that pressure and shoots the water, sprays it into the tank. That spraying makes such a fine surface area that the water is instantly carbonated. Now, you need to have it at 90 to 100 PSI because you're doing it at room temperature. So that's under extreme pressure. It comes out of that, goes through two circuits of your cold plate, right? Two circuits of it, and it's underneath your ice machine. So now you have constant ice supply, and you have constant cold seltzer. When it comes out, the next biggest mistake people make is they use a crappy picnic tap like you would use for beer. They're worthless, useless. You need to get what's called a Becker squeeze valve. You can also get Becker, B-E-C-K-E-R. Becker makes the best seltzer valves, no question, because it has a giant compensator in the back of it that allows you to make the transition from the high-pressure region where the seltzer is to the low-pressure atmospheric region, and they're free. It's freaking awesome. That's the system. So that's the system I have at 54 Eldridge. At home, the problem was I couldn't fit an under-counter ice machine in where I wanted to put it because it would have required too much ventilation problem. I just couldn't do it. Plus, with all the tubes coming down from my espresso machine, because my espresso and my seltzer rig are together right where all my filtered water crap is. So I have to go through the awful – well, it's not awful. I built an insulated box like out of wood and spray foam and blue foam with a condensation pump, right? You need a condensation pump. With a condensation pump. And so now my freezer, which is across the aisle in my kitchen, I pull the ice out of it every day from the ice maker, dump it into my insulated box, into the cold plate, and then that's how I get my cold seltzer. And so that's my cold seltzer rig at home. It's awesome. The one with the automatic ice machine is even better. Now that I have a 7-year-old that I can boss around, he actually does the ice. So it's just like having a manual ice, you know, a regular ice machine for me. But that's how I recommend doing it. It's the balls. I never run out of seltzer. Cooking issues.
You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.